Field Marshal Haig has formulated a brilliant new tactical plan to ensure final victory in the field.
Will this brilliant plan involve us climbing out of our trenches and walking very slowly towards the enemy, sir?
How could you possibly know that, Blackadder? It's classified information.
The final and best series of Blackadder, with Rowan Atkinson, is set in the trenches of World War I. Blackadder's unit receives its orders to go over the top into heavy machine gun fire because Field Marshal Haig wants to move his drinks cabinet 6 inches closer to Berlin. Haig was the commander of the British forces on the Western Front for much of that war, with Australian forces under his command. Haig saw himself as a kind of grim realist about what it would take to win the war and save civilization. He was certain the war would have to be won not so much by outflanking and moving past the enemy, but by wearing them down. And by wearing down, he meant killing them. By blasting, shooting, and gassing as many German soldiers as possible. Australian historian Paul Hamm returns to Conversations today. Paul's new book is about one of the most ferocious battles in that wearing down war, the Battle of Passchendaele in Belgium. This was the brainchild of Field Marshal Douglas Haig. Haig wanted to use the offensive to break the will of the Germans. Paul Hamm has spent the last few years in France and in Belgium walking through the fields and combing through the records to understand the reasons why the British, the Anzacs and the Canadians went over the top again and again and again, even though they knew they were being gradually and deliberately wiped out. And Paul's uncovered some of the outrageous politics that were going on in secret behind the scenes. His book is called Passchendaele, Requiem for Doomed Youth. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you, Richard.
I knew of Douglas Haig, Field Marshal Douglas Haig, Sir Douglas Haig, even as a kid, because my dad used to talk to me about him, and he used to tell me what a heartless human being he was and what a bad soldier he was and how many millions of lives he just frittered away. He seems to be still a controversial figure even today, a century later, Paul.
He certainly is, and for many years after the war, people were asking, what will people remember Haig for? And the word Passchendaele continually comes up, that this will be the battle for which he will be remembered. To call him a butcher, and the popular idea of Haig as this sort of monster is let's get this out of the way first. It is unfair. I mean, he spent the rest of, after the war, he was racked with remorse and guilt. He spent his rest of his life fighting for and defending veterans' families, writing letters to them. I mean, he literally worked himself to death on behalf of the survivors and veterans. But during the war, he thought, as you rightly say, that the only way to bash through the German lines was ultimately the war of attrition, to simply keep wearing them down. He dressed this up as, you know, we have objectives in mind, like submarine bases or territory or a village or a ridge. But ultimately, as he expressed in his last dispatch in 1919, this was about a chronic 4-year war of slaughter, where we would try to kill more of them, or at least at a faster rate, to kill them at a faster rate than they were killing us. Of course, Haig could draw in a much bigger army. He had the French army, he had the US, the Americans arriving, hopefully in 1918 at some point, and of course, the Commonwealth forces, the Anzacs and the Canadians and the South Africans. So a much larger force than the Germans. And the Germans, we have to remember, were blockaded, so their civilian population was being slowly starved to death, and their resources were being whittled away. So Haig was also winning the war of material, and the Germans were literally being slowly crushed. He knew this, and he was going to go on and on until basically it was, as Ludendorff said, you know, it was about the last man standing. And that's what attrition ultimately means. And people forget that this was planned. These casualties were not some sort of epic blunder. They were factored into the equation.
What? Are you serious? Really?
Absolutely. They called it normal wastage.
Normal wastage?
Normal wastage was this grotesque euphemism, which comes up in all the documents and all the cables. And normal wastage at quiet times during World War I was set at 5,000 to 7,000 casualties per week. Dead, wounded, missing, taken prisoner. Normal wastage during horrific times, during the Battle of the Somme, during Passchendaele, was set at between 20,000 and 50,000 casualties per week.
And was this a commonly held view on the front,
absolutely,
not just by the British commanders and the French
commonly
commanders,
held
and,
view.
And the Germans too?
Germans too. They factored into their equation, this is how many men we're going to lose. It's astonishing to read from our great distance. You see, it seems extraordinarily callous, but it was the euphemism they used and they accepted it.
Did that mean that if there wasn't normal wastage, then Haig would have seen that as perhaps, you know, his boys weren't trying hard enough?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at one stage during the Somme, at the height of the Somme in September, he said, this unit did not show enough offensive spirit. Their casualties were only around 1,000. So, you see, the logic of the equation of attrition is if we are losing this many men, then it follows that Germans are probably losing the same number or more. But what is lost in that equation is that the attacking force in a war of attrition always loses more casualties because they're attacking over open ground and the defenders are sitting in trenches and mowing them down. But you see, Haig knew that he could draw on a far greater pool of manpower. And so he could afford to lose men at a faster rate than the Germans could. And logically, that meant ultimately he'd be the victor.
Now, your book starts about 2.5 years into the First World War, and they've already had the awful Battle of the Somme. Was there anything learnt from that awful meat grinder that was that battle?
It was more than 1 million killed and wounded, total casualties, but there were hundreds of thousands killed. It was an absolute meat grinder, as you say. It degenerated into a pure war of attrition. Haig himself called it the beginning of the wearing down war. And some historians to this day defend the Somme on the grounds that it taught the generals how to use their artillery. There are several books on strategy which say, well, the Somme was worth it. We needed to learn how to use our artillery. I mean, tell that to the, you know, the mother and father of the son who died there. I mean, we had to teach the generals how to use their guns, which they could have probably learnt not at the Battle of the Somme,
perhaps,
you know,
yes.
Perhaps at Sandhurst.
Yeah.
But anyway, they learnt how to use their guns. And what they learnt was the use of the creeping barrage. It's very important to understand what the creeping barrage was, because they perfected it at Passchendaele. In essence, what it meant was you line up all your guns, thousands of heavy artillery, you fire them off at the same time, they land in a line, some way a kilometre or two in the distance, they form a storm of steel, literally a wall of flame and explosion and smoke. And every few minutes, they elevate the cannon and they move it forward by increments of 100 yards or so. This is mathematically planned. And so this storm of steel would slowly crackle across the landscape and over the German trenches. Now, moving up behind the creeping barrage were the Allied forces, the British, Anzacs, Canadians. And they could get fairly close to the inside edge of that barrage because, you see, obviously the shrapnel, the power is moving forward, the momentum's throwing the steel forward. They could get very close. And so once it had sort of moved across the German trenches, they would just leap in, bayonet the survivors or throw grenades around and take out their trenches.
Still, they'd lost all these people, these hundreds of thousands of people in the Battle of the Somme, on both sides. There'd been an unthinkable amount of casualties. Why wasn't there a moment when both sides, the leadership on both sides, wanted to stand back and go, oh my God, what have we done? We've got to patch up some kind of an armistice here.
So you're exactly right. At the end of 1916, the worst year of the war in terms of casualties, you had the French exhausted in a state of mutiny after the Battle of Verdun, a 10-month slaughterhouse. The most horrific conflict in human history. You had the Battle of the Somme, which was the Commonwealth response to the Germans in that year. It was a diversion. It was to help the French. The Somme was, in fact, a diversion. That was another absolutely horrific battle, the worst in British history. The first day of the Somme, you had 19,000 dead. So the Somme exhausted the Allies. It left the French army in a state of mutiny. Meanwhile, as 1917 dawned, you had the Russian army collapsing. They'd lost, they'd have a series of defeats against the Germans, but also there was an extraordinary enemy within, as the Tsar referred to the emerging Bolshevik forces. And so the army of the Russians was being urged to desert and just to give it up. So in early 1917, we were in a state of serious difficulty and staring defeat in the face. I mean, the Germans had fought Britain to a stalemate at the Somme and stopped the French at Verdun. They were feeling pretty good. They were being reinforced with these fresh regiments from the Eastern Front. They no longer needed, as they saw it, to fight the Russians into 1917. They could start sort of sending reinforcements to reinforce their armies on the Western Front in Belgium and in northern France.
So the Germans were in no mood to surrender at this point.
They were in no mood to surrender, and to take the second part of your point, yes. And the Allies didn't get together and say, well, we've got to talk about this.
Why not?
One reason, crucial reason, is that this now had become a war of vengeance. The propaganda, the press, all rallied behind. If you look at the British papers at the time, we have lost all these men. For what? We must avenge their deaths. We must continue this battle. We cannot negotiate with the Germans. We need to defeat them piecemeal. It needs to be an unconditional surrender.
Who was calling for that? Was it the newspapers or the political
cabinet,
leaders?
The cabinet of Lloyd George. Lloyd George became Prime Minister at the end of 1916. He launched a propaganda campaign to revitalise to rejuvenate faith in the war, in unconditional surrender, in defeating Germany. He was certainly not going to lose the war. So you remember, you have a new prime minister who is hell-bent on winning at all costs. And he sold this to the press, to the people. Meanwhile, a lot of people were losing faith. They'd seen the casualty lists in the papers. They'd seen what had happened to their sons and husbands. They'd seen the horrific injuries and that had come back after the Somme, the wounded, these unprecedented wounds to a man's face, to a man's body, and the public were losing faith in the war. And indeed, this wasn't just amongst the unions and the left and the Labour Party. Many Tories were losing faith as well, particularly a bloke called Lord Lansdowne, a Tory, you know, an eminence grise, who wrote a letter to the Daily Telegraph that year saying, "This has got to stop." It fell on deaf ears. Lloyd George and his cabinet were determined to continue the war.
Lloyd George, the new British Prime Minister, is a kind of fascinating man. He came from Wales, we know that. He was a brilliant orator. What kind of a man was Lloyd George?
It's difficult in the short time we have to navigate the circumference of this man. Not that he was fat, no, but he was monstrous in all sorts of ways, and a great orator, a brilliant salesman, an expert at manipulating events to his advantage. He was damned by his enemies as the cottage-bred opportunist from Wales. He despised English tradition. He was going to upend all the old saws, all the old certainties. He actually despised Douglas Haig. Haig, of course, being a lowland Scot of aristocratic heritage. In fact, one of Lloyd George's bete noires was inherited wealth. He despised inherited wealth, of course.
Because he was a man of ability,
He was a self-made man.
Right.
He was a lawyer. He was a journalist. And he was an incredibly able man, but he was also extraordinarily meretricious and very, very selective with the truth.
Right. Very devious. Very devious. He was quite convinced he was more capable, smarter and more capable than any other person in British politics. He was right, I suppose, wasn't he, in many ways?
He was a mountain. One biography described him as the great outsider, but as he got closer to politics and started to take control, he became the great insider. In fact, he turned the inside out. It became him. He changed the whole equation of politics. And some people refer to the way he performed during the war as a dictator. I mean, he had a very small cabinet. He transformed the cabinet into a five-man team, including him. And the men he had pointed to the cabinet were pretty much his yes men. They very rarely effectively challenged him. So he was effectively in charge. I mean, he said at the end of 1916, when he took power, "No more Sommes." He said, and this was the beginning of his explosive relationship with Douglas Haig. The men were in a state of mutual loathing as 1917 opened.
Oh, that's a dangerous thing, isn't it? Where you have your Prime Minister and your Chief Commander in the field, the Field Marshal Douglas Haig, in a state of mutual detestation of one another.
And it got worse and worse, especially when Lloyd George tried to shift command of the British Army to the French. In April 1917.
Now this kind of blows my mind. What Prime Minister connives to put the whole of the command of his own army under the overall command of the French? Was that purely about Haig?
It was purely about Haig, but he wanted it. But in fairness to Lloyd George, he wanted to take the command of the war out of Haig's blood-drenched hands. He said, "This man is a butcher. This man is going to exterminate the flower of our youth, and I will do anything possible to take the command of the war out of Haig's hands." And so he actually went behind Haig's back and connived with the French to hand control over to Robert Nivelle, the French commander.
Did he try to pretend to Haig that he wasn't doing this? Was he trying to cover his footsteps?
Oh, yes, he concealed it. He concealed it right up until the meeting in Calais, this extraordinary meeting when he just presented it as a fait accompli. And Haig and Wally Robertson, his chief of the Imperial General Staff, were just astonished. They spent the night fuming in a rage that they'd just been dumped on from a great height by their prime minister.
But here's where it goes wrong. You show this in your book, that Lloyd George put his faith in the French commander, Robert Nivelle, thinking he's a man with a plan, he wants to cut through, he wants a major offensive here, he's going to do it with dash and speed. And Nivelle had his offensive, and the whole thing was another
absolutely
terrible, bloody debacle. Did that then put the control of the war back in the hands of Haig?
Haig was then in a high point. I mean, even Lloyd George was forced by the Nivelle catastrophe to adopt a slightly contrite note.
Right.
Not a man known for contrition, old Lloyd George. I mean, and Nivelle failed spectacularly. I mean, he was the hero of Verdun, but his lightning strike against the Germans was supposed to take 48 hours to smash through their lines and open up into mobile warfare. That's what they're all trying to do, to turn this into a mobile battle where they could charge and Haig could unleash his cavalry, his beloved cavalry. I mean, Haig was a cavalry man at heart. And this was the idea, but Nivelle failed, and so suddenly Haig took the baton, and Lloyd George was obliged then to support his man in the field, his commander, and Haig then could resuscitate his great Flanders offensive. After the Nivelle failed in April 1917, the theatre of operations shifted to Flanders in Belgium.
Now, this great Flanders offensive that Haig had long wanted, you show in your book how, in order to understand why this went ahead, we have to understand what was happening in the sea lanes. British, as you say, had imposed a naval blockade on the Germans. How effective was this blockade on the Germans?
Extremely effective. It was probably one of the most effective weapon of World War One. It reduced the German civilian life to a state of beggary. They were being progressively starved. The number of people who died as a result of the British blockade of German ports was 800,000, upwards of 800,000 civilians over the four-year war.
What, died from lack of nutrition and medicine?
Malnutrition, and diseases relating to malnutrition. A few starved, in fact. But that figure is not a German figure. That's an accepted figure. 800,000 civilians died as a result of the British blockade. So it was extremely effective in crushing the German civilians, but also the feeding and supplying the German army.
So if this was a matter of life and death, this naval blockade, for the German people, mm-hmm. what was the German response to the British naval blockade?
The German response was the unlimited submarine warfare against neutral shipping, not just British shipping. Any ship that was supplying Britain would be sunk by the U-boats. The U-boats were operating out of the Baltic coast, out of north of the Belgian coast, Zeebrugge, Ostend, and other ports. And they were very effective. I mean, throughout in early 1917, April 1917, they sunk upwards of 600,000 tons of neutral shipping. Britain was desperate. I mean, they needed to find a way to neutralize this threat. It had the disastrous effect for Germany of bringing America into the war, of course. That's what brought the Americans into the war.
At risk of sounding like a bit of a Boy Scout here, Paul, was the naval blockade and unrestricted submarine warfare, were either of these programs in any way legal under rules of international warfare?
No, they were both illegal. The submarine warfare was condemned as a war crime. But, I mean, as in most wars, they just threw the rule book out. Poison gas was banned under the 1907 Hague Convention.
But I suppose trying to hold these powers to account, it's a bit like that line from Apocalypse Now. It's like handing out speeding tickets at the Indy 500, isn't it?
That's right.
Under the circumstances.
Exactly.
So there's this, on the one hand, there's the British blockade. Mm-hmm. The German response is unrestricted mm-hmm. submarine warfare. There's all this merchant shipping going mm-hmm. to the bottom mm-hmm. of the sea. Mm-hmm. This is why the British then fixated on the submarine ports, the naval bases on the Belgian coast.
On the Belgian coast,
Zeebrugge
exactly.
and Ostend.
Ostend and a few others, yeah.
And this was why they wanted to take Flanders, so they could knock out the naval bases?
Yes, that's essentially how Haig presented it to the cabinet. And it rang true. I mean, he never brought up attrition when he was selling his Flanders offensive. It was about attacking the ridge lines outside of Ypres, the Belgian city in western Flanders, and charging across the open plains if he can break through the German lines and then charge northeast to the coast and seize the submarine bases. That's the concept of the Third Battle of Ypres, as it was officially called.
So that's the plan.
That's the plan.
You move forward, you run over the German lines, you take out a couple of Flemish towns, including Passchendaele, head north, take out the submarine bases.
Submarine base, neutralise, at least go some way towards neutralising the U-boat offensive. Of course, there are other U-boat bases, you see. This is something that doesn't...
Was this plan put forward to the British cabinet by Haig in any way feasible, Paul?
It was feasible on the grounds that you had superb command, fair weather, fine weather, in other words, no rain, and a lot of luck. And you...
So not ideally, feasible. That's ideally, not feasible. I mean, ideally, you
had the French recovering and the Americans arriving.
Right.
Of course, the French weren't recovering. The Americans didn't arrive until mid...
1918.
In combat first, mid-1918. So you had it was basically a Commonwealth campaign.
So when Haig would have known that...
Yes.
So in putting forward the plan to the British cabinet, he would have been aware that this would have been a masterful stroke of good luck to achieve this plan.
He knew it was, yes.
Do you think he was ever serious then about the whole plan, about knocking out these ports in Belgium?
Oh, he was serious. He was a great basher. He was totally convinced, and he was a really... he had a very healthy ego. And also, he felt that his men could do it. He had great faith in the diggers and the Tommies. But the other thing that's interesting, he tried to tell the cabinet repeatedly that the French wanted him to do it. The French were asking him to do it to give them time to recover and to pin down the Germans in Flanders.
That was true.
The French never actually went to Haig and pleaded or asked him to prosecute the Flanders offensive. In quite the contrary, Ferdinand Foch, the great French commander, dismissed the Flanders offensive as a joke. He said it was ultimately futile. He referred to it as a duck's march through the Flanders bog, Flanders mud.
So this isn't looking good
at the outset, it's not looking good. And Pétain, the French commander, Pétain said to Haig, well, yes, we'd like you to go ahead because we need to recover. The French forces are still really in trouble. But he was exaggerating. He would rather use British casualties and buy the French more time. But you see, that lie, that exaggeration about how bad the French were off, and they were recovering pretty rapidly, fed into Haig's plan, because he then had something to go to cabinet with and say, Marshal Pétain has said he needs us.
So Haig presented this spurious plan to the British cabinet.
Yeah.
As a way of solving quite a few different problems then.
That's right.
On the one hand, it was going to pick up the baton from the exhausted and demoralised French. Mm-hmm. It was going to ideally go all the way up to the ports on the Baltic coast and knock out the German U-boat bases.
And pin the Germans down.
Pin the Germans down. It's going to do all these different things. Mm-hmm. The other thing you say is that Haig was utterly convinced that the Germans were close to breaking. Is that true, though?
No. He said this over and over again. Their morale has been crushed. This mantra went on and on right through the end of 1917 until even he was disabused. His intelligence chief, General Charteris, was incredibly unreliable and fed Haig what he really wanted to hear. And that was that the Germans are on the brink of collapse. They weren't. They were far from it.
It sounds to me, the way you put it, that Haig was never really entirely serious about knocking out these submarine bases, like the British cabinet wanted him to. What he really wanted was this full-on war of attrition.
His fallback position throughout World War One was that he is fighting a war of attrition. He's fighting a wearing down war. He is fighting a battle about body count. The intent was territorial gain. But the secondary consideration, which he didn't highlight, was that if that didn't work, then he'd fall back on attrition. So in all cases during World War One, it always became a battle of attrition. They tried to get around the wearing down with the Battle of the Trench Lines, and they did try various alternatives, but it didn't work. And so we come back to what we discussed earlier, normal wastage kicked in, and normal wastage was this horrific euphemism for chronic slaughter.
So Field Marshal Haig wanted this new Flanders campaign. This is what he'd been planning for quite some time. And they were going to break out of their base in the Belgian town of Ypres, spelt Y-P-R-E-S. Or the British called it Wipers, didn't they?
Wipers.
That's right. That's right.
Yes. Tommy rejoiced in mispronouncing Flemish names. I think the little town of Wieschiet, they called White Sheet. And Plugstuit, or another town they called Plug Street.
Plug Street,
and,
yes.
I can't even pronounce some of these names.
They were probably at risk of putting the Belgians and the French on the side of the Germans in that case with their mispronunciation of those names. But that's a risk they were prepared to take, I think. What had this little Belgian town of Ypres been like before war broke out?
It was a beautiful medieval town, 13th century. It once rivaled Paris as the centre of the textile trade. It was a rich city in trading terms. It had, however, a long history of conquest. It had been conquered by the Dutch, the Spanish, the English. It went on and on. But it kept coming back, and it was a flourishing town before World War One.
And what was it like at the start of 1917, though?
It was the most bombed town on the Western Front.
So there's almost nothing left of it.
It was rubble.
Right.
The beautiful cloth hall, the beautiful cathedral, these were just sticking out of the rubble, you know, like broken tombs.
Now, as you say, you rode a bike around all this area. What's it like today when you cycle around these parts of Belgium?
Well, radiating east and northeast of Ypres is a gradually rising plain, punctuated every couple of kilometres by a little ridge. I mean, a ridge is more at a slight elevation. It's very flat.
So does this give it like the effect of an amphitheatre?
A very shallow amphitheatre.
Right.
Squash it. And these concentric arcs radiating east and northeast formed what they call the salient, which is a bubble, a blister in the Western Front. And the Allies had held this blister since 1914. The Germans only took Ypres for one day. We held it for the entire duration of the war. And there were five battles of Ypres. They defended it tooth and claw.
Why was it so strategically important?
Well, it wasn't essential, but it was, I mean, some generals said it wasn't strategically important. Others defended it. We needed to keep it. It was very popular. To lose Ypres would have gone down very badly back in Britain. Oh. So there was a very strong popular case for holding Ypres.
Oh, it cost so much blood to take that to lose it would be catastrophic.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
So before this Flanders offensive started, the British held Ypres. The soldiers who were marching up towards Ypres, just tell me a bit about how dramatic that change could be going from the Belgian countryside up to the front.
This extraordinary thing about World War One, it comes through in a lot of diaries and letters, that they were marching through meadows and, you know, birds were singing and the grass was green and the poppies were growing out of gardens and there were villages that were still intact.
Well, and farmers going about their business?
Almost oblivious to the fact that a few kilometres further on, they could hear the guns, they could hear the roar of the artillery. And as they got further up, approaching Ypres, the landscape started to change and the dark brown soil started to impinge upon the meadows, and you suddenly found yourself in a war zone.
So it was like the opposite of The Wizard of Oz, in other words. You went from this beautiful, colourful world, light and wonderment and the natural beauty.
Very good image.
To this black and white moonscape all of a sudden.
A black, khaki, dark, brown soil was the brown land, as T.S. Eliot referred to it in his poem, grim in the extreme.
There was a preliminary battle before they could begin the major offensive at Messines Ridge, and this was very well planned, involved a lot of dinging, deep tunnels were dug under the German lines. This is around about where we get the story of Beneath Hill 60, isn't it, around this
period? Beneath Hill 60 is about the Battle of Messines Ridge. Right. There were 19 Hill 60s. There were 19 mines. 19 mines were blown up along that ridge line at Messines. This overlooks Ypres and overlooks the battlefield, so the Allies had to get control of it to stop the Germans bombing their advance.
So they dug these deep, very, very long tunnels.
Absolutely. They brought in miners from Australia. They brought in miners from Britain who were a week earlier had been digging the underground and the sewage tunnels in Britain, London.
So once they dug these big lines and packed the very ends of them with explosives, everything had gone quiet on the night that it was all to happen. What was it like from the German soldiers' point of view to be standing there that night when they all went off?
Yeah, there's Fritz sitting on these hills, this line of hills to the south of Ypres. And he's sitting there wondering why it's so silent, because the softening up bombardment had stopped. And usually after that, what they expected was the creeping barrage would start and the soldiers would come out of their trenches and start and charge and attack.
And that didn't happen.
That didn't happen. They waited there and they're wondering what on earth is going on. And it's early hours of the morning. And they hear this colossal explosion, which was heard in Lille. It's even heard in London. It was the biggest explosion up to that point in time in history. It blew up an entire hill. These hills were fairly substantial. And all the German soldiers on top of it were simply incinerated immediately. It became a massive graveyard.
And what did it look like if you're standing in one of these pillboxes?
You're sitting in your pillbox and it just blows up. But they're seeing them coming towards them because they blew up over a period of seconds. So the German soldier to the south of the explosion could see it coming towards him. And he realised he'd be next. And, of course, hysteria and panic set in. And they were scurrying around these hills like maniacs trying to escape what they could see coming towards them.
So they easily took them.
They took Messines relatively easily. Well, the counterattack was ferocious because the Germans excelled in counterattack.
And so this, obviously, the success of this first initial phase, this preliminary phase of the Great Flanders Offensive, strengthened Sir Douglas Haig's hand enormously. Mm. Did Lloyd George still have his doubts about the whole Flanders plan?
Yes. He opposed it from the beginning, but he couldn't really impress that upon the military commanders.
Why? Because he had lost the Prime Minister.
Well, exactly. But what he said was, after the disaster of Nivelle, as we've discussed, he had lost authority. He said, okay, I'm handing it over to Haig, but I'm not going to tolerate any more Somme. So he said, I do not approve of the Passchendaele offensive. I'd rather shift operations to the Italian front. And he kept banging on about the Italian front throughout the war. But he bowed down to the majority view amongst the military commanders. Said, "Okay, you go ahead with the offensive, but if it gets bogged down as the Somme did, I reserve the power to intervene and stop it." Now, of course, he had that power anyway. He didn't need to sort of, strike a deal. He could have intervened at any time. He was the prime minister. But that's the arrangement that they sort of came to.
But.
There's always a but.
Here's the thing. Just taking a step back here, the whole reason in his mind and in the cabinet's mind why they're doing this whole thing is to knock out the German submarine bases on the Belgian mm-hmm. coast mm-hmm. because of the unrestricted submarine mm-hmm. warfare. But at this point, you write, Lloyd George and the British cabinet and the Royal Navy had found a solution to unrestricted mm-hmm. submarine warfare, mm-hmm. which was to surround them with...
Yeah, absolutely, the convoy.
There were convoys, mm-hmm. right.
Well, I'm very glad you raised that.
Yes, because this is a critical point
absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So at the time the Flanders offensive is about to go ahead, mm-hmm. they've already found a solution, mm-hmm. and their knocking out of the naval bases isn't so critical anymore. So if that's the case, Paul, mm-hmm. why are they still doing this? Why are they going ahead with this?
It's a penetrative and excellent question, which goes to the heart of this offensive. And the high watermark for the German U-boat offensive was April. After that, Lloyd George imposed upon the British Navy the convoy system. The convoys worked like, a herd of wildebeest. The wildebeest protect their young and their older wildebeest in a convoy, in a herd.
In the centre of it,
In the centre of it. So you had the little fishing trawler, the mercantile marine, in the centre of a convoy of destroyers. That was how it worked. It seems fairly obvious, doesn't it, that you don't present a single target to the U-boat, you present a mass convoy. And this effectively neutralised the U-boat offensive, which was petering out in about June, July of 1917, just when the Passchendaele offensive began.
So why isn't Lloyd George saying, we don't need this plan anymore, we need to rethink what we're going to do next?
Well, history is hard, history is complex, and we need to look at overlapping motives and overlapping incentives here. Lloyd George couldn't put his hand on his heart and say, we've defeated the U-boat offensive as of June. The submarines were still there, and there was still a case for taking out the submarine bases, of course.
It also seems like once you press the button on these great offensives mm-hmm. and you're going to move nearly a million men in arms up to a front line, mm-hmm. that these things have their own momentum.
They have their own momentum, and this certainly gathered its own momentum. And mm-hmm. Hague was in the strong position after the failures of the early part of 1917. And the other thing you have to admit, that once they had sort of charged to the coast, Hague's ultimate ambition for the Flanders offensive was to force the Germans out of Belgium. I mean, it was a war-winning scenario in his head, and it would have justified or fulfilled the original case for Britain entering the war.
Oh,
so it was very popular back
Belgium.
Home, to protect Belgium.
Yeah.
This is about, defending that neutral country that for whom we'd gone to war for. So in other words, Lloyd George, though he was Prime Minister, was in a difficult position then. So he never gave the Passchendaele offensive the green light, but he accepted that we would go ahead with it and see how it went.
What
and if
a
it failed,
mess.
He would intervene and stop it. That's what he said.
What a mess.
Absolute mess.
What a bloody mess. Now, of course, normally a major offensive like this would, in an ideal situation, would be conducted, be prepared for in utter secrecy. That didn't happen. The Germans seemed well aware of the preparations for the offensive. Was it even possible to conceal preparations?
No, it wasn't possible. I mean, they had prisoners who were telling them they knew from January. They all knew. They were prepared. And they'd built up their defensive networks. There was the strongest defensive shield the Germans had ever created. They had trench after trench after trench, rows and rows of concrete pillboxes perched on the tops of these rather shallow ridges, looking down on the plain below. And over those plains, that's where the Allied soldiers, the Commonwealth soldiers, I should say, because it was purely a Commonwealth campaign, by and large, would have to charge.
Opening bombardment of this great offensive, the 15th of July, there's this massive row of British guns that fire and fire, and it's tearing up the ground. Mm. But this time it's different. What went wrong after this initial bombardment?
You had the softening up bombardment, which is the prelude to the beginning of the creeping barrage, which was the herald to the Germans that the invasion had started. So the creeping barrage begins at the end of July, 31st of July. The soldiers are in there in their trenches awaiting the dawn, having a smoke, urinating, getting ready, and the whistles go, over the top they go. Now, this is the early week, the first week of August. Within a day of this opening attack, the heavens open, the rains come down. Throughout August, you had the worst rainfall in Flanders for 70 years. It rained and rained and rained. The effect of this, after you've had the softening up barrage, the softening up bombardment, was to pock the landscape with shell holes, large, deep shell holes. It was heavy artillery. And the rain filled up those shell holes. Soldiers, mainly the Tommies at this point, supported by the Anzacs, were spearheading the attack. And as the rain got worse, they stumbled and fell. The artillery couldn't come forward because they were coming forward over mud. The shells were going off target. And it ground to a halt, a horrific halt. And if a man fell into a shell hole, he would drown. I mean, he was weighed
down.
Drown
in mud?
Well, he was drowned. It was liquid mud. And the thing was, it was our own creation. Because once you had destroyed the natural drainage system of Flanders Fields, the water couldn't escape. It sat there in the bog, in these plains beneath these ridgelines, and just gathered. And what happened was, if you fell into one of these deep shell holes, you couldn't be hauled out because the duckboards, these were narrow duckboards running between the shell holes, and there was no traction. You couldn't sort of throw a rope. They didn't have ropes or chains that they could pull men out. And they couldn't just swim. He was weighed down by 25 to 30 kilos of you know, his rifle, his rucksack, his grenades, and he slowly sank. And this happened to horses as well.
Horses drowned
horses
in the mud?
Horses and mules were floundering, thrashing around. It was the most horrific sight for the soldiers to see their beloved horse that had dragged up their artillery get blown into a shell hole and struggle to get out. And they shot the horses, but they couldn't shoot the men at the beginning. Later in the Flanders campaign, they had shot the men because drowning slowly in a pool of liquid mud was the most horrific death. I mean, there was one diary which records going up to the front, seeing a man up to his waist in mud, pleading for help. They come back a few hours later and he's up to his neck in mud, pleading for help and having gone insane, just howling at the moon, just an absolute wreck of a man.
In the midst of all this, of course, I suppose the Germans are sitting up on a ridge in pillboxes. Mm. Raining down machine gun fire on all these people.
August ground to a halt. They were forced to call it off. September comes. The sun comes out. The ground hardens slowly. And in late September, they launch new attacks. These attacks are spearheaded by the Anzacs. The British are basically a supporting unit. They had been seriously damaged in August, throughout the August battles. So we send in the Anzacs, and the creeping barrage then was effective because the guns then had firm footholds, firm ground on which to fire. And the late September battles were successful. The meaning of that word is that the creeping barrage stormed the German lines. The Anzacs went in at places like Polygon Wood and captured their positions. When we say captured the positions, we mean that they captured maybe 1,000 yards deep. They advanced about 1,000 yards and captured a band of territory and dug in, reversed the German trenches which they'd captured, and prepared for the next bite, and they called it bite and hold. They would bite off a chunk of German territory, hold it, bring up the guns, and charge, and take another bite. And they were going to do this over and over again until the Germans capitulated and it ended in mobile warfare.
So after months of bloody fighting, we've given up all hope of taking the Belgian ports here. The Anzacs took their objectives.
In September. Then October comes. The cruelest
October
month.
Comes. But looking at, as you've got that on the map there, it's so tiny, Paul. It's like the increment on the map is like, it's like such a small amount of land.
It was the greatest concentration of shell fire in the history of the human race up until that point, focused on the smallest region. So the body count per square yard was the highest of the war. You had a body part per square yard at the end of some of these battles. It was absolutely horrific concentration of men, animals and machines that we'd ever seen. And so that's why it was so horrific and so ferocious, and men were crushed by it. The morale was far worse out of Passchendaele than it was after the Somme.
And driven completely insane, surely, absolutely. Too, I mean, by the terror of it all.
The terror of it drove.
And the noise and everything
else. And you see it from the Germans' point of view, and I devote some parts of the book to looking at this from the German point of view. They're sitting in their trench lines watching the creeping barrage coming towards them. They can see the instrument of their appalling death or mutilation approaching them. So they're sitting there, they can't run back because they're going to be shot. Ludendorff made clear, very clear, that no man would desert his post. So they just waited for certain death to approach. The survivors, of course, were then subjected to waves and waves of Tommies and Anzacs leaping into their trenches.
How aware in London was the War Cabinet of the extent of death and suffering in Flanders at this time?
They were well aware. They received the weekly, daily often, casualty lists. And Lloyd George was absolutely horrified by the casualty list. But they were not aware of the actual conditions. This was shielded from the cabinet to a certain extent. I mean, Haig himself at certain critical moments was unaware. A lot of the divisional generals were unaware because, you see, they were well back from the action. They were dismissed today as chateau warriors. To be fair, they were in their French chateau directing operations. They did have runners, they did have messengers, they did have their officers who were informing them of the conditions. But there's a few famous moments where one of Haig's generals went up to the front, and he was shocked to the marrow by what he saw, and he said, "My God, did we send men into that?" And now this is disputed that he actually said this, but if he didn't say it, he damn well should have said it.
Yes.
That's what's lost in those who criticise this moment. They don't realise that, you know, he damn well should have said it, and he should have said it to Haig. Haig himself, later in the war, looked at the casualty lists. And he looked at the casualties for the year of 1970, and he said, "My God, have we lost 500,000, half a million men?" So it astonished him when he looked at the cumulative effect of his war of attrition.
At this point, Haig believed he had to take the village of Passchendaele. What does the name Passchendaele actually mean, Paul?
Well, it really ultimately derives from the word "pati" in Latin, to suffer. Passchendaele evokes images of Easter and
the
Passion of Christ.
So Christ's death in agony on the cross.
Absolutely. I mean, this is it has heavy religious overtones, and that impinged upon the minds of the soldiers and the generals. They saw this as almost a cross on the hill that they needed to take, and it really did back home as well in the press. They always referred to the Battle of Passchendaele. It became a sort of a Christian icon. We must take this village. Haig himself became obsessed with the idea of taking Passchendaele, and so did some of his generals, particularly General Godley, who was in charge of the New Zealanders, and whose command of the New Zealanders led to their destruction. And this, for the New Zealanders, this was the worst war in their history, the worst battle in their history. They were literally crushed at Passchendaele.
The Canadians were brought in to take charge of the offensive, and finally, because the Anzacs were worn out and decimated. And the Canadians were appalled, but eventually they took it. But why? Why did Haig not call off the battle? Why did he want to have one last push for no apparent gain to take Passchendaele?
Can I just say one thing about the Canadians? Their general, Arthur Currie, predicted 16,000 casualties. This is how exacting the casualty estimates were. In the end, it was 15,800 and something. The Canadians won 9 Victoria Crosses in taking Passchendaele in a couple of days. But why did Haig continue to prosecute the battle? Passchendaele was his fallback position. If he failed to take Belgium, if he failed to take the submarine bases, if his war of attrition ground to a halt, at least he would take Passchendaele Ridge. It wasn't just the village, it was the ridge, which was regarded as a jumping-off point for his next bite, his next hold, his next attack on the Germans. So at least, surely, with all these casualties, he must take Passchendaele Ridge. And so he was determined to do so. His whole reputation, his whole legacy rested on this. And if he had failed to do so, Lloyd George would have not only had a great excuse to sack him, but to damn him forever.
So it was taken at the cost of extraordinary casualties.
271,000 casualties. Over 4 months, they gained 8 kilometres. 271,000 dead, wounded, missing. Missing meant blown apart.
And this was so Haig could declare a victory.
Declare a deeply Pyrrhic victory. It wasn't a victory. It was a failure. It was futile. It ultimately achieved extremely little and damaged our chances of winning the war, as Lloyd George pointed out. I mean, it seriously crushed our morale. It had a most deleterious effect on the Allies. And the other question, of course, is if Haig was determined to prosecute the battle up to the point of Passchendaele Ridge, why did Lloyd George not intervene?
Why not?
Well, he'd said so, hadn't he? As we discussed earlier, he'd said, the Prime Minister had said, if this gets bogged down like the Somme, I reserve the power to intervene and stop it. He didn't stop it. He didn't lift a finger. That's the question that goes to the heart of my book in terms of its political narrative. Lloyd George himself answers it to a certain extent in his own memoir. He said, if I had stepped in and stopped Haig and stopped the generals from their war, I would have been damned as the meddling politician. I would have gone down as the man who, he didn't say this, but a man who thwarted the army from their determined efforts to, after all these losses, taking Passchendaele and maybe even getting to the coast.
Yeah, but who cares what they will say about you? You've got to do the right thing, surely.
Well, surely, but these men are very proud, men very egocentric. They're looking at their place in the history books. Well, they've got one now.
Yes, they do. Yeah. And here we are sitting around talking about him a century later, you know.
Well, exactly. Yes. Lord George did nothing, and he sat there watching. He knew what was happening. He knew that this was a spectacular failure as of August. And later, in his memoirs, he glosses over why he failed to act. He claims that he was misled, that he wasn't fed the right information. It's absolute nonsense. But he wanted this battle to be seen to be Haig's failure. There's deep Machiavellian power politics going on here, and it rings very true when you look at the bitter struggle between the two men, and which goes back, you know, 2 years.
Paul, looking at this major offensive as part of the much larger war and the awful stalemate of trench warfare, was another kind of war ever possible? Like, it seems terribly mistaken that you would wage a war of attrition when you should really try and slip past the enemy, outflank them, get around them, take territory off them, isolate them, leave them to wither on the vine, and then take their capital. That seems like the way you win a war. The point of the war isn't to have the last man standing. The point is to win, isn't it? And win as quickly as possible.
Excellent question.
Was there another war ever possible?
It was possible. It was attempted. Haig and his generals tried over and over again to find a way around the War of the Trenches, to break through, to bring on the cavalry, if you like. That's the ultimate expression of mobile warfare. So they originally tried the Nivelle Offensive was the original sort of attempt at the lightning strike. You throw everything at them and you try and smash through, and that failed. Then they tried the bite and hold. You take a slice of German territory, you hold onto it, then you creep forward. It's a version of attrition, but at least it's more likely
it's
to win.
Yeah,
They tried aircraft, they tried tanks. Tanks got bogged down in the mud. They tried gas. I mean, Haig was a great believer in gas. They threw tons and tons of gas at the Germans. The Germans are the first users of gas, of course, and the first users of mustard gas. We quickly cottoned on and used mustard gas in huge volumes. That all failed. All of these methods failed, and in the end, Haig then reverted to his second strategic consideration, which was the war of attrition. We will wear them down until they buckle, till they crush, till their morale is broken. Now, when Haig failed to do that at the end of Passchendaele, and once they'd taken the village, he held it for a matter of a couple of months. It was seen as a jumping-off point if you were going to go further. But if you're not going to go further, it had no strategic or tactical value whatsoever. So they held it as almost a nod to the government that we've got this is a spoil of our huge campaign, but it meant nothing. And then they abandoned it within 2 months with further hellish loss of life. That was after the Canadians had actually seized it. So Haig, helplessly, at his nadir, when he himself was pretty much crushed by Passchendaele, in the early 1918, said to the cabinet, "This is not working. We ought to sue for a compromise peace." Even the field commander was at his wit's end to know how to, we will lose the flower of our youth if we continue this battle.
So let me ask it another way then.
Yeah.
Haig's talk about a wearing down war, that kind of grim-eyed view of how that war should unfold as a war of attrition, was that right? Was that the best way to look at victory at that point, and as monstrous as it is?
Well, this is the view of those. This is the essential argument of those who defend Haig, that he fought the only war he could within his limitations. John Terrain, the great biographer of Haig, is a great apologist for Haig, believes that he fought the only war he could.
What do you think?
Well, I'll tell you what I think. What I think is that, given that this was the only war they could fight, and it had been proved over and over again, as we've discussed, they tried these various options, it failed. Given that this was the only war that they were reduced to fighting, do we then apologize for them and say, well, they did a pretty good job after all? But that removes, in a sense, the human agency from this whole campaign. They're saying, well, they did what they could, but they were helpless. And in fact, Haig's character becomes almost irrelevant. The generals are just floundering around in the mud like the soldiers, doing what they could. Well, surely, humanely then, that imposes upon us a key question of World War I. And I think it's the cardinal question that we all must ask ourselves about any war. When should the government intervene and say stop? And given that Haig himself had confessed pretty much that he couldn't break the German lines, the governments then had a duty to their people to intervene and sue for a compromise peace and negotiate and mediate. Now, they didn't do that, and I believe they utterly failed the societies they ruled or represented, the Germans, the British, and the other governments involved.
So you hold Lloyd George? ultimately responsible for this debacle.
Responsible. His memoir is an extraordinary exercise in self-exoneration. And he blames Haig. He throws the whole box and dice at Haig. You just have to read the chapter. A whole chapter of his memoir is devoted to Passchendaele. It's called the Campaign of the Mud, in which he holds Haig personally responsible for the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of young men. Now, this is just outrageous. It's an extraordinary thing. Ultimately, the man who could have intervened and said he would failed to do so for all sorts of political reasons which the book explores. But ultimately, this is where the buck stops. But I believe other governments in unison should certainly, looking at what this war was doing to young men, to the future of their countries.
Just finally, Paul, you've written compelling books on Kokoda, on Hiroshima and Passchendaele here. When are you going to stop looking at Holocausts? When are you going to lighten up, buddy?
Thanks, Richard. You know, it's a great question. And my next book is not one of these tomes. It is, in fact, set in the 16th century. And I am trying to lighten up. It's a dirty job.
Plague, surely, or what?
It was a pretty grim world in the 16th century. You look at the 20th century and you think, well, what is it? And you are forced to. That's a century I'm focusing on. I'm interested in the connections between these events, and you are forced then to confront what actually happened.
Let's make a better job of it in the 21st century. I hope we can.
Yeah.
Thank you once again, Paul.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Paul Hamm's book, Passchendaele: Requiem for Doomed Youth, was published late last year. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
It's science.
For me as a scientist.
It's culture.
Imagine.
And everything in between.
Do you know what this means?
Natasha Mitchell here. Join me for season one of Science Friction. From radioactive Boy Scouts to self-experimentation. All species welcome. Science Friction. Listen via the ABC Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.